We're digging into the Net Zero America study on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When President Biden took office, he pledged to meet the urgent needs of the climate crisis in his first joint address to Congress in April.
If we act to save the planet, we can create millions of jobs and economic growth and opportunity to raise the standard of living amongst everyone around the world.
What worries you most about climate change? Can the U.S. unify in a strategy for clean energy? What changes do we need to make in order to avoid the worst consequences? 800-642-1234. Eric Larson is a senior research engineer at Princeton University's Andlinger Center for Energy and the Environment. He was lead author of the study called Net Zero America. It's a blueprint for how to achieve net zero emissions by 2050. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Well, let's do a barometer reading first with your feelings on our changing climate. Are you hopeful or worried about the prospects for avoiding catastrophic climate change?
Well, I'm certainly worried about it. On the other hand, I think we have a chance to avoid that if we get together and work hard.
I'm
mixed.
You have mixed feelings. And, you know, I think about your net zero report like, you know, a choose your own adventure book, if you will, that was popular when I was a kid. And you have these different pathways to arrive at this destination. What prompted you to do this study that took a couple years, 18 researchers?
Yeah, well, I'm an engineer, trained as an engineer, and engineers are taught to define a problem before they try to solve it. And I didn't feel that there was a good understanding of what it would actually take to get to net zero emissions, which is the goal for by 2050 for avoiding the worst consequences of climate change. So we decided to do this study to try to really paint a picture of what it would take. And we ended up painting five different pictures of pathways that we could take as a country to get to net zero by 2050, and they're all quite different from each other. So you can pick your favorite one, as you were suggesting.
Can you explain what does net zero mean?
Yeah, net zero means we don't put into the atmosphere any more greenhouse gases than we remove from the atmosphere in any given year. Greenhouse gases, the most important of which is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is taken up by trees and plants and so on. And that's a natural removal from the atmosphere. We're adding CO2 to the atmosphere through combustion of fossil fuels. And essentially, we need to balance how much we're putting into the atmosphere with how much is being taken out.
And currently, we continue to add more and more, being out of balance, so to speak.
Yeah, we're about 6 billion tons of CO2 going into the atmosphere, more than we're removing from it just for the U.S.
We're talking with Eric Larson, senior research engineer at Princeton University. He's lead author of Net Zero America, exploring ways that our country could reduce greenhouse gas emissions to lower the impacts of climate change. And you can join in. Are you concerned about climate change? Do you think it's possible to quickly shift to green energy and electric cars? What problems do you foresee in this transition? 800-642-1234 to join in. Eric, your report found that our country needs to make enormous dollar investments in infrastructure, and in doing this right away, $2.5 trillion by 2030. What investments need to be made?
Well, so let me first say that to clarify, these are investments. They are not costs in a sense. We are investing money in order to have an energy future that we all hope for. But the sort of the annual spending of the individual is not going to be too much different than it is than it has been historically. So it's important to keep that distinction in mind. This is an investment, not an extra cost, if you will. Those investments get paid back over time when we use energy, we pay for electricity and so on. That pays for those investments. The kinds of investments that we'll need in this decade, the $2.5 trillion that you referred to, is a lot of solar and wind energy, electricity generation, on the order of 500 gigawatts, if that means that number means anything to anybody, of new solar and wind capacity by 2030. We need to build additional transmission, electricity transmission, to be able to carry electricity from where it's generated by the wind or the sun to where it's used. We'll need to invest in electrifying the vehicle fleet and electrifying heating in homes, for example. And that way we can eliminate the fossil fuel that's used there and instead use electricity that's made without carbon emissions. Those are a couple of the bigger areas where investments are needed, but also across industry. And the beginning of planning and designing a CO2 pipeline system as well, which we're going to need in the 2030s and 2040s.
Yeah, we're going to look more closely at this CO2 pipeline system, but give us a sense of scale here. How much money do we spend on powering up our lives? What portion do we spend on electrification?
So to start at a really high level, the annual spending of the country on energy for all energy today is on the order of 5% of gross domestic product. Mm-hmm. And that percentage is going to stay about the same going forward in these net zero pathways. How that breaks down into electricity versus fuels versus home heating, we haven't broken down the numbers at that level of detail, but again, the $2.5 trillion, we've broken that down. About a third of that is in going into solar and wind, new solar and wind capacity. 20% or so is going to go into transmission expansions, and the balance goes into other areas.
And of this $2.5 trillion, would this be government investment? Would it be corporate investment and corporate decisions, or how would that work?
It's really all of the above. Okay. It's ultimately it's going to be largely private capital that is spent, but the government has a big role to play in incentivizing the spending in the right places.
Your team identified six pillars where investments need to be made in order to get to net zero. And this first one that we've been talking a little bit about is end use efficiency and electrification. What does this involve exactly?
Well, electrification, I'll start with that, because when you electrify, for example, converting a combustion engine vehicle, a car, and switching it to an battery electric car, you gain a lot of efficiency by doing that. You need less energy input into the vehicle to go the same distance. So that's a double benefit of switching to electricity, which you can provide through non-carbon emitting sources, and requiring less electricity or less energy to run the car. The vehicle electrification is important. And then similarly in residential heating, when we replace a gas furnace with what's called a heat pump, which is an electrically driven system for providing heat, again, there's an efficiency benefit that comes with that. So those two are the biggest factors in electrification when we mentioned that first pillar.
Why are heat pumps better than traditional gas furnaces?
Because they're more efficient and okay. Because they can run on electricity. So it's like your air conditioner is basically a heat pump. It takes warm air out of a space that you want to be cooler, and it dumps it into a warmer space, which is outdoors. And you just reverse that for a heating heat pump. Takes heat from from the cold air outside and puts it in, inside.
We have Princeton University's Eric Larson, who was lead researcher in a study called Net Zero America. It outlines five technological pathways for our country to decarbonize the economy. Are you hopeful we can solve climate change? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll talk more in a minute with Eric Larson here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the climate crisis and a blueprint for reaching net zero greenhouse gas emissions over the next 30 years. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Extreme heat, catastrophic wildfires out west, scientists shocked by the scale of flooding in Germany and China. Is climate change happening at a quickened state? We're exploring a report that would help us get off this trajectory. Princeton University senior research engineer Eric Larson is with us for the hour. Let's bring in David now, joining us from Viroqua. Hi, David. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. You know, right now, if I remember my numbers right, 40% or more of our greenhouse gases are getting created by heating and cooling our homes and buildings. And we, my partner and I, have a construction company out here, and all of the houses we're building now are, you know, R42 walls, R80 to 100 in the attics. They're super tight houses. You know, we're actually, our last house is actually beating passive house standards. And unless we start building all of our homes that way, every house that gets built that doesn't make it is just going to be a drag on this system, you know, for the entire lifetime of the house. And we're just not going to get anywhere. So I'm really hoping that builders will kind of take this up and, you know, start doing what they need to do to, you know, cover a big piece of this problem.
Yeah, David, thank you. You know, Eric, David's saying super tight houses that they're building, but everyone, there has to be buy-in.
Yeah, I mean, David's got a great point that goes beyond even the building of homes. The point is that when you build, when we build something, it lasts a long time. And so we need to make really smart decisions when those opportunities come up where we're rebuilding something or we're replacing something, whether it's a home or whether it's a car or whether it's a factory. We need to make the decision now to build it for a net zero future, in order to that we don't end up having to discard something that we've built without using it for its full lifetime. So I think that's a great point. I'm happy to hear that David's construction company is doing what they're doing.
Along those lines of the structures we build, Tom in Lake Geneva would like to bring more up on that. Tom, go ahead.
Thank you very much. David had a great point. We are an architectural firm. We've won four national awards. We've done projects in Japan, Belarus, Russia, just a very small firm. But our structures are no longer responding to the weather situation.
Oh, Tom, I think you just got cut off. Are you still there, Tom? No, it sounds like we lost Tom. But, you know, Eric, Tom was saying that our structures are not responding to the weather patterns that we're seeing and that buildings absolutely need to change. You know, as you look at your pathways, how do you take that into account?
So I guess what Tom's talking about, maybe sometimes the word adaptation is used to adapt to the changing climate to the extent that it does change. We don't explicitly consider that in our modeling. It's an issue that can be and should be thought about as we modify the energy system. How can we make it at the same time more resilient to things that might happen as a result of the climate change we're committed to that amount of climate change.
Tom, are you still there?
Yeah, and I would really like to comment. You have a great program. We are heavily involved in these beautiful monolithic thin shell concrete dome structures that actually go not just net zero, but net zero plus. they're making so much more energy than they consume that basically the surrounding utility companies by federal law must purchase these. But our structures are like R80, our domes, let's just take a high school, for example. We can put up a high school for at least 25% less initial cost. We could do it in a third of the time. Our structures are indestructible. They would not know a 800-mile-an-hour tornado was happening. And we go from lead to plaque to gold easily.
Yeah. So concrete dome structures going net zero plus there, Eric.
So I guess that means maybe there's solar panels on these structures that are generating electricity and putting it back into the grid while not requiring any more within the building itself. That's great. I think the challenge there is to scale that kind of activity to the rest of the country and to all of the architecture firms out there, so that that becomes the standard, or that, you know, that type of thing becomes the standard. That's the real challenge, I think, in net zero. It's not that we don't have the technology or the understanding of how to do things. It's how do we scale it?
Could we power the country entirely on wind and solar, or will alternative generation be needed?
Well, one of our five pathways, we required that by 2050, the only energy sources that we're using are renewable energy sources, and that's mostly solar and wind. That one requires a huge amount of solar and wind generation to be installed. If we're able to do that, then we can run the country that way. Again, the challenge is not so much a technical or technology one. I think it's more about how do we as a country, as a society, change our habits and the way we build things and how fast we do things.
Let's bring in Dan in Westby. Dan, hi.
Hello. Your first caller, David, actually did a lot of the work on our house, which was an old farmhouse, and we had, we added a few rooms and did some energy efficient changes, including a solar system. We have eight solar panels and 16 batteries to power two freezers, a refrigerator, some ceiling fans, and some of the lights in the house. But after 10 years, our first our main array of batteries failed, and I had to replace them. And so my question is, have you factored into your report the production of solar and wind and other alternative energy generating sources? You still need fossil fuel to make these things. They're very expensive, and when they fail, they need to be replaced. And I don't know if the folks who really think that we can run this country on solar and wind have factored that in. So that's my question.
Dan, thanks. Eric.
Yeah, that's a great question. So it takes energy, it takes materials to build all of these devices that we're talking about here, solar panels and wind turbines and batteries and so on. In our study, we did not take into account how that would impact the overall energy system. I think that's an important area to dig into further. My guess is that it would have some impact, but maybe not a huge one. That's just my sort of gut feeling before doing the analysis. But it is important to think about. And in the case of batteries, our models don't actually deploy as much batteries as you might imagine, because they are pretty expensive, and they don't provide you with sort of long-term electricity storage, like seasonal storage.
Mm-hmm.
And they're good for sort of offsetting, when the sun goes down, you have batteries for a few hours, But beyond that, it gets quite expensive to try to store for long periods of time. So our modeling finds other ways to balance the variability of the sun and the wind.
Yeah, because that's been such a hurdle. Demand fluctuates, and trying to keep that battery life is really difficult.
Yeah, exactly. And so the options that we have, the one that's used today in the power system is called a gas turbine, which burns natural gas. But over time, we can transition those to burn hydrogen, which is a non-carbon emitting source if we make it from a non-carbon source. And in our models, we end up with a fairly large number of these what are called simple cycle gas turbines that can be turned on and off as needed to balance the loads.
Research engineer Eric Larson with us. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're tackling climate change, responding to a listener request that we devote more time on this front here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two global meetings to watch in October and November, the G20 summit, the 20 countries that produce the vast majority of the world's gross domestic product, followed by the UN Climate Change Conference. Samantha Gross, she runs the Energy Security and Climate Initiative at Brookings Institution and told NPR.
The G20 and the G7, they're small enough to get things done and they have enough in common that they can work together. And they're also among the largest emitters. If the entire G20 got on board, you would cover the vast majority of the world's emissions.
Princeton University senior research engineer Eric Larson led a study on how the U.S. could reach net zero emissions by 2050, and he stays with us for the hour. Let's go to Jeremy now in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think a lot of people should take some time and start reading up on some literature in regards to climate change and what it will take to really get it done. A couple of years back, I read a book called Getting Green Done. And the author really focused mostly on industry. He believes that industry is the determining factor that would change the course of climate change and as far as lessening it, more so than me changing windows in my house.
Mm-hmm.
Places like Walmart, Amazon, manufacturing sectors, things like that, changing the regulatory system to accommodate them as well as reduce our footprint is probably a more sustainable and and more impact have more impact than me doing stuff at my own house.
Jeremy, thanks. Let's flip that to Eric, that we should really focus here on manufacturing and industry.
So Jeremy makes a good point that's an important sector for sure. I think ultimately to get to net zero, it's gonna require all of the above, essentially. But the point that he made about changing regulations is really important, really, really important. And that applies across the board, not just to manufacturing and industry, but also to building codes and vehicle standards and so on. Those are the kinds of changes that can then permeate and change the sort of the scale at which change happens in the country. So I think industry is important, certainly, but I think even more important is the changing in the way we regulate and the way we write laws about how things get done across the board in the energy system.
What about the impact of carbon credits and the fact that, you know, the prices for wind and solar have been falling?
Yeah, the wind and solar are becoming economic on their own they've been supported by government subsidies for a long time, and that's why the costs have come down. What we need to do in other areas is similarly, we need to support other technologies until the costs get to be more competitive. But yeah, solar and wind today can compete on its own, but we will need to go even more aggressively in building out those technologies than just sort of the natural course of letting the market take its own pace.
Yeah, and along the lines of building out transmission lines, one of the findings of your report is that our country needs to expand high voltage transmission line capacity by 60% in order to deliver energy produced by renewable sources. And these lines have been really controversial, especially here in Wisconsin in our Driftless area. So why are these lines needed?
Yeah, the 60% number that you mentioned, that's by 2030. And beyond that, we need to expand even further. The reason they're needed is if we want to take advantage of wind and solar, but particularly wind energy, that's often located in places where there are relatively few people living and relatively little electricity demand. And so we need to be able to move that electricity to places where it is needed. And that's where the transmission lines come in.
Coal is completely phased out in your scenarios, but, you know, decommissioning coal plants takes time. How do you account for the immediacy of these transitions and these phase outs? How does that work?
In the case of coal, because it's such a carbon heavy fossil fuel, the least costly way to get our reductions in the near term is to shut down coal plants. And that of course has economic implications for places where that are reliant on coal. And what we've done in our modeling is we haven't explicitly accounted for those kinds of disruptions that might happen, but we hope that by showing explicitly what the modeling, what getting to net zero requires, including what it implies for coal, that we can plan ahead and make adjustments to communities that are dependent on fossil fuels today, such that they don't suffer the same impacts as might happen if there weren't any planning that went into it.
You know, how would communities suffer? And, you know, Wisconsin gets a lot of its energy from coal, and then you have coal-producing states like West Virginia.
Right. So if coal power generation goes away, then coal mining goes away, which is in West Virginia and Wyoming and North Dakota, where coal is produced. Those jobs go away as well. But in our analysis, we've also modeled the employment, and on the whole, there's many more jobs in the energy sector in these net zero futures than there are today. But the locations and the types of jobs will change over time. So mining jobs will go away, but there'll be new jobs for installing solar and wind farms, operating these facilities, and so on. So there needs to be a careful attention paid to jobs in particular where they're dependent on fossil fuels today.
Eric Larson is a senior research engineer at Princeton University's Andlinger Center for Energy and the Environment, lead author of Net Zero America, as we explore ways that the U.S. can reduce greenhouse gas emissions to lower the impact of climate change by 2050. And let's go to Brad now from Fall Creek. Brad, you want to bring up hydrogen fuel?
Yes, I know Eric alluded to it, but it seems like a lot of programs, they talk about alternative energy and they do not talk about hydrogen fuel cells. Now, California is going to hydrogen fuel cell cars. They have the infrastructure put in place so they can use them. British Columbia just announced that it's going to hydrogen fuel cells. But what a lot of states aren't doing is putting in a delivery system for hydrogen. And also with hydrogen, you don't need batteries to store energy. Cars that are currently gasoline engine cars could be converted to hydrogen. And even for furnaces and so on that are natural gas and whatever could be converted. So it'd be, I think, a much better way to go than to electric and to batteries.
Eric?
Yeah, that's a good observation, Brad. In our study, hydrogen fuel cell vehicles play a big role in the heavy duty vehicles, the trucks and buses. Those are where batteries have, struggle a bit more to compete there. The cost of electric vehicle, sort of conventional car electric vehicles, those are coming down quite rapidly. And our model chooses the battery electric car for light duty vehicles, but does go to fuel cells for heavy duty vehicles. The other important point to make about hydrogen is it depends, how good that is as a low carbon fuel depends on how you make it. So hydrogen today is made by starting with natural gas and basically separating the carbon from the hydrogen, but then releasing that carbon into the atmosphere. So there's still some carbon emissions, even though you're using hydrogen. In our model, we have three ways of getting hydrogen without the carbon emissions. One is to put carbon capture on the facilities that are using natural gas to make hydrogen and capture the carbon rather than release it. A second way is called electrolysis, which is taking electricity and splitting water. So if we use clean electricity and we split water, we get hydrogen and oxygen, and there's no emissions associated with that. And then the third option that we have is to start with biomass or plant matter. And that's a carbon neutral material because it's taken carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere as it's growing. And if that carbon goes back to the atmosphere, there's no net increase in carbon to the atmosphere. So we can take that biomass and use it to do what's called gasification and make hydrogen out of it. And that we can either release the carbon that comes out of that process, or we can actually capture it. And if we capture it and store it, then we actually have negative emissions hydrogen. So all of these play a role in our different pathways that we've modeled.
And your 3/4 of CO2 is stored on the Gulf Coast. Is that right?
Yeah, we have we're lucky in the U.S. in that we have many parts of the country where it's suitable to put CO2 below ground for storage. Typically, if you look around the world, the places that are most attractive for doing that are places where have historically been oil and gas production, just because of the geology. Fossil fuels have been held underground for millions of years. And so the geological structures are there to keep things in the ground. And so, yes, in the Gulf Coast, about 3/4 of our capacity for storing CO2 is down in that region. But there are other parts of the country, including underlying Wisconsin and Illinois, what's called the Mount Simon Aquifer, which is a saline aquifer. It's not a drinking water aquifer, is suitable for CO2 storage as well.
Research engineer Eric Larson of Princeton stays with us on the Net Zero America study. He's mapped the infrastructure that needs to be built and the investment that's required to run the country without emitting more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere than are removed from it. Still time to talk about climate change and next steps, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Eric Larson on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation on climate change and a study out of Princeton University that charts an effort for the U.S. to reach net zero emissions of greenhouse gases by 2050 using existing technologies. And the study, it comes at an urgent time as we see rising temperatures, flooding, hurricanes, wildfires, other catastrophic climate events. Eric Larson is senior research engineer, lead author of Net Zero America, and he's with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Jacqueline now in Williams Bay. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hello, WPR. Thank you for having me on. And thank you, Eric and everyone, for your efforts to prevent climate change. I'm a licensed social worker specializing in environmental justice and human and animal welfare. And I'm sending out an SOS from a wellfedworld.org from our organization in Washington, D.C. and the Vegan Center here in Williams Bay, Lake Geneva. And we feel strongly it's imperative to address the rising sea levels and global warming and the wildfires happening all over the world right now in combating climate change. It must be addressed with climate change. It must be infrastructure, Eric, your electric cars, solar, wind power. These are all great efforts, but it shouldn't be the only way of addressing this grand challenge. And not everybody can afford those costs, the individuals, the communities. We feel strongly it must be addressed with education on evolving to a plant-based diet.
Well, Jacqueline, I want to pause there and ask Eric, what impact does ag-related emissions have on your scenario modeling, and can you get farming to net zero?
Good question. We in our modeling, we considered what's called non-CO2 greenhouse gas emissions, which are things that come from agricultural activities and other areas. Those are tough to get down to zero. And so, for example, we use a lot of fertilizer for growing food, which is a lot of fertilizer, which is nitrogen containing, and it ends up putting what's called N2O, nitrous oxides, into the atmosphere, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas. It's difficult to imagine agriculture without some fertilizer. We can be smarter about how we apply fertilizer so that it there's less of those emissions, but it will be very difficult to get rid of them altogether. And so that's where you need to have negative emissions to offset those, essentially, where we do things like growing trees, for example, or this biomass process for making hydrogen that I mentioned, where we capture CO2 in the process and put that below ground. That's a negative emission. So it's going to take that's one of the six pillars, is reducing non-CO2 emissions of greenhouse gases, but it's going to take all six of these pillars to get us to net zero.
Yeah, explain these carbon sinks and how you would deal with methane released by livestock.
Yeah, so carbon sinks are the way we refer to them in our modeling. It's things like growing trees. It's things like changing agricultural practices to low or no-till cultivation, which will store carbon in the soil over time. It's good farming practice as well. So those sorts of what are called land sinks, we rely on improving those over time. Currently, we're actually taking a fair amount of CO2 out of the atmosphere because our forests are regrowing. But as the forests slow down in their regrowth, as they mature, they take up less CO2 every year. And eventually they will sort of stabilize and stop. It'll be a net balance. So we're actually reducing the land sink if we don't do something. So we need to take active measures to enhance the land sink. And that's one of our six pillars.
I want to take some moments here to look at jobs. Your report dug into the potential jobs that could be created. And Russ in Pleasant Springs would like to bring that up as well. Russ, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. My question is for your guest is, what do you think would happen if you eliminate the fossil fuel jobs, say in Virginia, and you got a miner that's been doing that who is 40 or 50 years old, been doing that all their life? You're going to be able to retrain them to work on a wind farm or some other job at that age?
Russ, thanks. Can this happen where, you know, you retrain someone who's worked in coal for decades?
That's a tough question for me. It's not one that we've studied in detail. I'm aware that in the past there have been retraining programs that perhaps can be used as models, or at least lessons learned. I think it's a big challenge. And I don't have an answer for it, but I think if we plan for it, if we see it coming and we consciously work to make sure that everybody's taken care of in this transition, I think we're going to be better off.
Yeah, in your modeling and in your granular look state by state, would Wisconsin stand to gain a lot of energy jobs?
Yeah, in fact, well, across the country as a whole, just in the next decade, our pathways, regardless of which of the five we follow, it's about 500,000 more jobs in the energy sector than a sort of business as usual future. So, and Wisconsin, you know, has its share of those. So in aggregate, and I don't believe there's much in the way of coal mining in Wisconsin. I'm not positive of that, but so I think there's less impact from loss of coal jobs.
What is the health impact? Because you also looked at possible health benefits with this.
Yeah, the health impact is, as you might guess, if we eliminate pollution from coal plants, if we eliminate pollution from mobile sources like diesel trucks and combustion engine vehicles, there's big health benefits. We estimate across the country as a whole, on the order of, a 500,000 avoided premature deaths due to air pollution. And we actually have numbers for Wisconsin. It's on the order of 5,000 avoided premature deaths over the course of the transition. From you know, reductions in air pollution.
Your report has been out for some time now. What response have you gotten from policymakers on it?
They've been very interested to understand what's in the report. We've given, I don't know, maybe 100 briefings to folks in Washington of various stripes. So there is a real thirst for understanding the details of what needs to be done, which is what we were aiming to do with our report.
What are your next steps? Where do you take it from here?
Well, we've identified a number of different areas where I think we need to do more work, and a number of them have been raised by callers here this morning, which is great. We are going to actually issue an updated version of this report, and I'll just make a plug for the website. It's easy to remember, netzeroamerica.princeton.edu, and you can see our data, all of our data there. We want to be as transparent as we can about what we did with our work, and hopefully that makes it useful. So by the end of the summer, we'll have an updated version issued, and we'll just keep going with what we call deeper dive analysis into specific areas that we think need attention.
Eric, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Eric Larson is a senior research engineer at Princeton University's Andlinger Center for Energy and the Environment, lead author of that Net Zero America study. And we have a link also to the study, wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.